Welcome everyone to a new episode of the Finance Weekly podcast. And today we have a very special guest. We have Frank Antepas from Cobland. Frank, it's a pleasure to have you here. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, and it's my honor to be there.
It's great to have some experienced podcaster host in the podcast, a fellow podcaster that I've been following since I, you know, introduced in FinOps, and much more than a podcaster for sure. And you already like been doing some great work in FinOps. So maybe we can start with you know, some introduction for people that don't know you before we start with the big guns, top down FinOps. That is your, you know, the topic of today.
Okay. So yeah, I'm Franck Contrepoix. You can guess from the accent that I'm not British native, even if I'm based in London. Overall, what I've been trying to do over my career is to be a full stack person. And so, for example, what I mean by full stack person is that I started as a developer in my garage, not wanting to talk to human beings, then discovering talking with human beings that was useful. I became an exec in a company in a startup that got sold for $1 billion. So that was quite a stressful environment. I've done something to learn about how the board reacts, so a non-executive director diploma, it's called, and it's quite cool too. So the idea is I want to understand finance, I want to understand the board, I want to understand the executive, and I want to understand the developers and the engineering team, all of this together. I have to admit, it's slightly hard to keep track of all of this, but it's fine, it's doable. From your perspective, yeah, I've been, FinOps has been now, from the beginning, really, I was at FinOpsX, the first one. I had a short talk about forecasts that day. That was really funny. And yeah, with Stephen Auld, we used to work for the same company, which was very FinOps company, but thinking from the banking perspective, which was really cool. We for 5 years now, more than 5 years, we've been doing a podcast once or twice a month. So yeah, that's me in a nutshell. Yeah, no, well, now I have my own francontrepoix.com when I share my ideas analysis. And yeah, I think too much, some people say, so it's fine.
No, thinking is good. So yeah, I definitely recommend everyone to go check a look at your website, because you could find very interesting articles that have been featured a couple more times in the newsletter. So definitely quality stuff. So let's start with the main topic of today, which is like top-down FinOps, a topic that you have been developing for a long time. And, you know, for the audience to know, like, when you say top-down FinOps, what exactly, like, do you mean? How is it different, sorry, for another approaches that we have in FinOps?
Okay, so think of it this way. Until now, we almost... And I think I wrote about this. Yeah, bottom-up FinOps, so the opposite of top-down, is ask engineers to fix things with no connection to the strategy. So it is when you go into, when you start, most of the documentation you have in FinOps is about, and the complaints also, is about engineer not taking actions, or I have a list of lots of recommendations they should be doing, all these kind of things. This is what I call bottom-up FinOps, because yes, it comes from the data, but it doesn't have any real connection with what at the exact level they might need, or even just at the VP level, who pays the bill. Yes, you might reduce my cost by a certain amount, but if you are reducing the speed of delivery, I might not be that interested in the savings. Or there are lots of things like this that let's put it this way. The default FinOps approach is bottom up until now, most of the time. And we're trying to get access to, I would say, top management and executive and C-suite, mostly for sponsorship. This is slightly changing, but until now, they were just a participant, someone to inform. So executive were here to sponsor you. You were to inform them and they would be here to sponsor you. While on the other side, what I do believe is their job is to make decisions, take the responsibility when these decisions go well or bad. And then depending on this, so they make bets, depending on these bets, you want them to be implemented. And we are completely missing that bit. So for me, top-down FinOps is to give back 60 to 70% of the data, which usually is enough to make a executive to decide what they want to do What is the risk they want to go? Do they want to go all in on, obviously, like AI? I need to say AI in any conference. So do they want to go full speed onto AI? Do they want to deliver much faster? Do they want to increase their margin? Depending on that, they might choose different option of implementation. And that needs to go then down. And that's what you need to implement as a FinOps team. That's your priority. Your priority should not come from a tool. Your priority should come from your boss. And that's what I call top-down FinOps, is we give back the decision-making, the risk also. We save ourselves. We are more secured because the risk is handled by people who are paid and trained to make decisions and risk.
Yeah, that's a very interesting approach because, you know, FinOps is such a, I believe that it's such an important, you know, practice and such an important thing to the company, that it was weird or strange that the thing was coming bottom up. Like, you are implementing changes that are super important and super relevant to the company, but going from the bottom, which is fine, like to get, you know, a promotion or whatsoever. But then the strategy and the, you know, that kind of important changes need to come from the top down, because, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but, you know, it's such an important strategic decision that the ones that need to decide are in the top and not in the bottom, right?
Yes. And you've highlighted also, there is a very interesting thing about top-down FinOps. It's vastly different depending on the company. You say that cloud, in this case of FinOps, is very important. It will depend on the companies. So my short version is that if the company is on a very thin margin, so very small margin, the CFO has more power than the CTO. And cloud is probably, if I do glasses or if I create that stuff for my house, cloud is, yes, it's a necessary evil for something, but it's not my business. So at that point, as you say, FinOps is less relevant, or cloud is less relevant, ideal also. On the other side, if you're on a fat margin, you're probably a startup, you're probably in tech. And at that point, the CTO will have more power because they have more capability for spending, because there is money in theory. So the strategy, the top-down FinOps, that's part of what I'm saying, is, do you know what your company is really targeting? Do you know in which what really would make an impact? There was an interesting discussion recently about what can go into the balance sheet. So for those, and what can go into CapEx, OpEx, it's the usual something. You need not to talk. It's a hell of complications.
Yeah.
But overall, what we're talking about in here, it has tax implication. It has assignment. It has investor relationship implication, which is why it's not as simple as, oh yeah, OpEx is best. The other point that came to my thinking is how we live in a bubble. Okay. We live in a bubble of cloud, and in that bubble of cloud, we've been shaped by the marketing of cloud vendors. Okay. Let's put it this way. By default, if you know, CFO would say yes to cloud if they're in their right mind. Because you ask and say, how much is it going to cost? I don't know. Can we put a cap on it? No. Or is it going to cost us another, I don't know how much, in technical setup? I can put alarms. You say, yeah, but that's too late. I don't care about alarms. How do I? And so the point being that you can see that the reality is, me, for example, the big cloud vendors started from shadow IT. It was someone in the dev team that bought with their credit card something to do a project. And that was cool because cloud is brilliant. And so it was really cool. It was working and it grew and it grew and it grew. And now it's reaching the CFO, which starts saying, what's that stuff? What's the margin out of it? How much does it impact my tax? And you say, well, my EBITDA? Where's my? I'd say, oh, yeah, well, that reduces your EBITDA. It makes it worse. I'd say, well, I'm not interested in that stuff. And so we have that conflict at the moment. And the people in the bubble that we are fighting back, saying, no, no, our way is good. And you're there, no, cool down 2 seconds. Part of top-down FinOps is starting to put yourself in their shoes. Okay, we've been managing money for more than 5,000 years. Okay, so they probably know something. We've been managing cloud for the last 20 computers for the last 50. So 50 to 5,000 mean that they probably already have a name for it. They've probably have seen it. They've probably have tried it. And it might not be in IT. It might have been in trains, might have been in olive, in agriculture. I don't care. The point is, it's been already standardized in lots of things. And so part of the top-down FinOps, I'm saying, the impact is for us in that cloud and FinOps bubble in particular is a good dose of humility and starting back, coming back, as you accepting that we are biased in our decision, in particular from the marketing. And last but not least, I'm talking about reserved instances. I'd like to talk to people that they are neither reserved nor instances. And they are the word I hate the most in the cloud world, by the way. But it's and the small fun story. It's one day we went to with my boss, Dr. James. We went to talk with the CFO, and the CFO was saying, "I don't understand that stuff." And James was very kind to explain what, in financial term, what an ROI is and how you can sell it on the ROI marketplace for 12%. And the answer was, it's a forward buying contract with an embedded put option at 12% out of the money. Okay? That is done. The CFO knows how to account for it, how to manage it, the risk implied, but they never use that in AWS because they talk with the tech people. And they don't want it to spread because, as I say, CFO might not see that uncertainty and unlimited spend. Positively.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, if you have dealt with, you know, finance people and accounting people, they want to have things like very under control. And, you know, as also reserve instances is something that is super, I think it's one of the most trickiest thing to think about, because they are very similar to what a CapEx buy would be.
Yes.
But they are not.
No, they're not.
And that's I think that's deserve like a whole podcast on the reserve instance, like saving plan thing, on how to account for it, because it's
No, I think you can't. So the point is, we did some research. You cannot really account. Oh, but the accounting is obviously going to be extremely complicated. And by the way, just say that was one of the things we used to do, is to help people, because every time you buy a, let's say, a 36 months RI, so 3 RI. Every month, the accounting team need to count it how it is. Because if you spend $1 today, is not $1 in 3 years' time. There is inflation in the middle. So you need to start accounting that on a monthly basis in advance. There is a ton of accounting work for anything partial or full upfront, which is why I think on the new RIs for DB or savings plans for DB, they've just removed any other. It's nothing upfront.
Yeah, it's like, if you are into, like, that's one of the things that I like about FinOps, because I come, you know, from the tech side, but I also like the finance. And when I see, like, finance stuff, and it's super, super interesting, and, you know, it's very tricky. But, you know, moving on to the top down. So we have thought about, you know, how the responsibility has swapped from, you know, swaps to the bottom, to the people, to the top down. But some of these things, like those cascade of tools and some practices, is like, how do you cascade, like, from the different teams, from the top down, without feeling like this is super mandatory, this is a policy, like, you know, how do you do that so it's embedded into the whole org?
That's interesting. So there is a say that your creativity comes from constraints. Okay. When I used to, I have a beautiful book on programming, which is called Programming Pearls. And it is from the very beginning days when you had 664K of memory. Okay. And your problem was bigger than 64K. How would you solve that? And so you had that constraint that was forcing you to think through and find new ways and innovative way. So what I see is that, for me, top down FinOps as policies, and it is mandatory, but it's set the way you need to do it. And that's why you have multiple layers. I think on one of my articles, I've highlighted 7 layers. They are theoretical layers. But the idea is that if the CEO says, we're going to be a lean company for HR, that means that, you don't fly business. But for the cloud, it might be that, hey, you do not use the latest generation because prices are going up and you're just going to stick to. But by defining some constraints, you create what I call the sandbox. You create a perimeter where the developers or the engineers, they don't have to think if they are doing right or wrong or going back to the architecture. Now, that's fine. That's covered. I can focus on the real problem I have. And so if we were to say, look, we're going to be old style. We're just going to do three-tier architecture. The database we're going to use is Postgres. The intermediate we're going to use network load balancers, EC2 instances, only spot, 80% spot, 20% non-spot. And I don't know, application server in the middle, whatever. And you just say, hey, that's what we're going to use for the next year or 3 years. It frees you as a developer to say, okay, how can I optimize that? How I can go deep dive into Postgres optimization instead of thinking, oh, I should use DynamoDB for this and key values should be in the other store and that there and then it's going to be hell on earth. So the way I see it, yes, it is mandatory. Yes, it comes with policies, but those policies, if well done and the hierarchy is right, are going to be freeing you from, they're going to give you a pitch in which to really play freely without having to be responsible for stuff that were totally out of your control or.
Yeah. And definitely you highlighted something very interesting that I totally agree on. That is like, you need to, you know, constrain a bit the development cycle, even though, like, for certain cases, like, I don't know, AI things or all of that, you need to, like, okay, let's frame this and let's see what's the new thing. But for the general, like, software development, you can constrain what is best for your company, because you can then, like, optimize more, like, on the performance side, on the technical side, on the price side. You can then, like, if you have a stack, like, that's something that, you know, a lot of SaaS builders said that, you know, you stick with your stack and then, like, you will be much more productive. So innovation is great, like, in tools, and there is always new tools and all of that. But then if you constrain it, you become the best at your stack.
Exactly. And that's value, I think, also. Yes. And there are software, it's interesting to say, and you work for one of these companies, which are enterprise type of company. And the enterprise type of company, they are here to stay for years because they manage things that you cannot change easily. If you have a supply chain, you produce a product and you have a supply chain that goes through China to India to the US to Europe to whatever, you need a software that holds it up together and it needs to have a strong base. That's what I've noticed. Enterprise software have a very strong base and then you can adapt on top. And almost every, so let's say the Oracle, the SAP, the Salesforce, they're all based on that model. And that's something maybe we don't have yet matured in FinOps. We have tools that try to tell you, oh, those are the best practices. And you say, well, cool down, maybe not for me.
Yeah.
And I think, yeah, that's it.
And you know, talking about, you know, best practices and saying that what you just said about, you know, that's not for me, maybe it's for another company. So that relates to one of the topics that I wanted to discuss today, which is context, right? So you have said in multiple times that, you know, yes, context is everything. So, you know, why context can be sometimes more important than the actual numbers that you can see?
Yes. So I think I will tell a longer story later on. I think they will, when we talk again about context is everything. But to start with, context is, think of it in a very simple way. We all have brilliant dashboards now out of fashion because now we decide that it's not enough and we all need a chatbot. But overall, when you look at any graph, okay, if I tell you 46%, you have no clue what I'm talking about. There is no context attached to it. And that's what, if you look at the, if I will say the Kudos dashboard, because I had the pleasure to working a lot with it, pleasure. It's a ton of information without context most of the time. And you just, so I've, we, with Steven, we did a talk about this, that there are five things you need to have in every graph to make it useful. You need to, and to add that context. And the first one is the data. Yeah, thanks, God. Second one is some text. Explain to me, if I were to tell you that those 46% is an intake of fruit and vegetable in my diet every day, that would already make you more understandable. But then what you need to have, and which almost everyone misses, is what is good What am I targeting? Because I don't know if 46 is good or bad. And the same way, I need to have a good, which can be a value or a range. And then you need to have also what is bad. What is the bad range? So you need to have the number. You need to have some context with text. You need to have a good. You need to have a bad. And the last thing you need to is to explain what good is good and bad is bad. So for that example, and it is the one we've used in a, I think in a keynote we delivered at one point, it is, imagine if I tell you that the goal is to get to between 25 and 38. And I say, why is that? Well, because if I have less than 25% vegetables, I'm probably ingesting too much fat and too many sugars. And so it's going to be bad for my health and cardiovascular thing. If I am above 46%, I'm probably not taking enough protein in and I will need to. And so at that point, if I tell you 46%, showing you the ranges and all the stuff, I give you full context. You will understand that graph without me having to tell you anything. And that's why, and that, I am a data guy. I love dashboards and stuff. And I think we are just throwing numbers at people and telling them, you should learn my stuff to understand these numbers. And I totally disagree with that because I'm very opinionated.
And I also agree, like, I also deal with a lot of data, and like a lot of data can be useful.
Yes.
But with the proper insights, like I can have, I don't know, we can see like bills and, you know, all these excels, and you can have like, okay, I have a lot of data and a lot of visualization and all of that. But one thing is like, okay, what do you do with that data? What does it mean? Why is it relevant for you, for your clients, for whatever? So, you know, talking about this and adding more about like, how does adding this context change to what decision people make when they have like this data and then you have context, and then how does it change for the decision?
I think it put into, as we say, into context in this case, but it's, think about it. When you have an engineer, they'll have a certain salary, and we all have a sensibility, for example, to money, which is different. Okay. We say, oh, if I'm earning tons of money, I can say, oh, $100, that's irrelevant. That's a small amount of money, but $1 million is always going to be big. But if you have a Fortune 500 or even 2000, really, and you say, $1 million is irrelevant. It's just, it's peanuts. But if I am the person in the FinOps place or the developer, I might find it very important. I hear continuously, you can see people tell you, oh, you could save $300,000. And you say, yes. And I don't know if that's important, because $300,000 is just the price. Potentially, I used to manage 40. I had a team of 40 developers working for me. And you end up and say, yeah, I can tell you that their salary, okay, they're all earning quite a good amount, is way more than per month. So, no, I'm not stopping. I'm not distracting them, even 2 days, all these people, to do a hackathon for that amount of money. It's just no go. And these kind of things, I think, is what the context brings. Is when you bring the context, it brings clarity with those constraints that we talk about to every individual. So I know that in my company, any savings that is less than 10,000 needs, or better, for every 10,000 saving, it needs not to take more than an hour of time, engineering time. Does it take more than that? Yeah, it's not worth it. That's a context that is really useful for me, because all of a sudden I don't need to make decision based on my biases. It's been decided top down that this is a number that match, and that number is communicated to me through context.
Yeah, that's something that it's very interesting, and I can totally relate to that. I recall when I was, and probably that had happened to some people as well, that when I was starting to do FinOps in my company, and some others as well, like, if you are doing like $100 in savings a month, and your salary is more than that an hour, then you need to do it in like 5 minutes or something. Because the human, let's say the human cost that you have for let's say for the human resource that you are for your company, is not worth it. Like, yes, it's not worth it. So you need to take that. You need to, as you just said, define a decision process so that you know, people can make the right decision, so that they define, like, okay, let's do this or let's not do this. You define your decision, like, process, so that we can apply to Freenode, right?
Yeah, context is transfer of information. It is, and sometimes it's limited, but yeah, it is transfer of information, and it works very well with a top-down thing. Is this is the context of our company, this is the strategy, and that goes down through the right channels, through the right people whose job it is to make this. So, yes.
And, you know, you mentioned before, like, you had a story yes. to tell us about the context. So can you tell us more about that?
Yes. This is a story that comes from one of the best books that I invite everyone to read, by the way, which is the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. I don't know if you've got that one. But there is the story that is the story in the tube. And so it is, imagine yourself. So this isn't imagining, but imagine yourself. You are in the subway, whatever city you want, and you've just finished a hard day job, okay? You're tired, you're exhausted, you're reading your Kindle there, and you want some time. All of a sudden, it's chaos, absolute chaos, because you have 2 kids that are jumping around, smashing things, kicking, all touching people. They slap your Kindle. You get so upset. And they are old enough to do a chaos, but not old enough to be on their own. So you look for the parents, you know, someone to blame on tilt. And you go and you find the father who is completely lost and seems to ignore all of that. And you get very upset. Okay. So you are very upset. And you look at that person and you say, get a grip on these kids. They are doing chaos. And that person tells you, so the father tells you, we come back from the hospital. They've lost their mother. I don't know what to do. They don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. Okay. At that point, the chaos is there. The facts are there. If you were to measure things, nothing has changed. I just want to hug that person and make sure these kids are going to have all the emotional support they can get. The only thing that changed is the context. And so when you read a number and it doesn't have context, it's useless, because we are emotion-driven people. So that story for me shows, and I have shivers every time I tell it, because I think of myself, if you want, and you're there. It's enormous. And I would completely change my behavior. And it's not bad. And so I invite other people, not in an extreme as this way, for example, but to put yourself into someone else's shoes. Learn that finance bit to understand why are they being so painful with some aspects. It's assume, give an A. That's another from another thing. But give an A. Start by assuming that people are doing their best and they are smart. And that's you are missing something. Mm-hmm. And ask for that something.
Yeah, that's like, that was, I recall about that story from the book, and it was very powerful to showcase as an example. It was like, and the way that it was written, it was very, very good a very good read. So I definitely recommend people to do so. And I totally agree. I think that can be applied also in finance, but in general business, yes. Like, if someone is pinging you or someone is, you know, you're not understanding why they are acting some way, you probably need to ask, like, why, you know, the reason behind it. And they'll probably, like, dive deeper, and then you will know, like, what's behind. And that can apply, especially when you are, like, getting into more management, more business style, you deal with more people.
Yes.
And we get with more emotional, and, you know, decision-making is something that you need to dive deep into, like, okay, what's the whole thing behind this? So we can reframe, as you mentioned, ourselves, so that, you know, we get to the right point, we get to the right solution. Everyone wants to have like a win-win solution, and that's it. If not, then, you know, that's someone you shouldn't be doing business with. But that's a super powerful example. And, you know, so we have talked about the context and how it affects us, but, you know, most of or several people that are listening to us may be working in a big company, in an enterprise. So how people can implement context at scale? So like for a big company, like where do you start, like on the first place?
Well, you start, so it goes, as we say, probably with the top-down thing. So the first thing I would invite people to do, even today, and I think that's is if you are in a big company, you're probably a public company, or even if you're not a public company, you have investor report, you have strategy report. Have a look at your quarterly report, okay? Have a look at how the company define themselves. What are the risks that the company as a whole is thinking about, that they are presenting back to investors, that the board are looking, because we talk about the board as if they should care, like all this stuff. Have a read at these documents and you will discover they read. There is a big bank that is a lot in the cloud and all, and we were all use cases and success stories, all the stuff behind it. And then you go into their report and you search cloud. And there are three references to cloud and they're all in the same paragraph. And they talk about weather. And it has nothing to do with IT. So you look into the IT thing and you find that some of the cloud in IT or the IT vendor was named on the risk side of things as we have a single vendor. And you're there, okay. So these kind of things, well, even just reading this shall help you understand what is the board really think. And there is a really, really, really good chance that they don't give a monkey about cloud or IT. IT for most companies is a necessary evil. The only one it's not a necessary evil are usually startups. Because even when you, because when you get to a certain size, even let's say Microsoft is a tech company. We all agree with that. How much are server important compared to programming and creating license or managing your licenses or other people around? IT is vital, but still it's not the main value driver.
Yeah, I think that what you said about the necessary evil is like something that we, like coming, especially from the technical side, we need to reframe ourselves, because we think, you know, the development, the applications that we do is the most important thing of the business, and we are doing a critical thing, and, you know, we are super important. And that's fine. Yes. Like, self-esteem, and that's super great. But sometimes, like, if you are working for a supermarket or something like that, the thing that brings the business is to sell on the supermarket the products that you have. Exactly. Not the IT infrastructure that goes behind it and monitors everything and whatsoever. If they could avoid it, they would do it, because the only thing that matters is to sell the products and have quality products that people would buy with a good margin. Yes. That's business. And all that comes behind is just a necessary evil. Like, mostly, like, you can think with legal, you can think with, you know, IT. It's all necessary things that you need to make it happen, right?
And let me be a little more positive on this again with some sort of story, but because I want to highlight the good thing of cloud. But the way I express it to company, I say, hey, if you are doing every company big enough as employees, and so they're doing payroll, okay? Mm-hmm. So you do payroll. And in the past, I used to have to manage some payrolls, and you would have a payroll, and you'd have a cutoff date, which usually was 10 days before the pay, so that you would stop and say, at that date, we cannot approve holiday expenses, all this kind of stuff. It's going to be backported to next month. So sometime you would have to wait a month for something done, I don't know, a week before payday, because they had that cutoff. And that was normal. And that was because you were limited by the amount of power it would take to build. You had four servers to do all the accounting, monthly accounting. But cloud changed that. All of a sudden, you can ask, how long do I want that cutoff? And if you were to say, hey, I want it to be 1 hour. So, okay, to 1 hour, you need 2,000 servers. Say, well, let's get 2,000 servers 1 hour before. And all of a sudden, all the admin work of the cutoff, all the backlog, all the bad complexity of, oh, pass my expenses that day because it's going to be before the cutoff and all this kind of stuff, they just disappear. And that is, for example, the power of cloud. Is if you have some problem which can be solved with quantity or things which are one-off, and that you need, like, the one-off, you need massive, just do it. When I was at Strategic Blue, we had a guy, it was before all the AI craziness, He's a researcher at University of California, San Diego, and he told us, he said, I want to buy every spot GPU available of all three cloud vendors in all regions in the world for 1 hour, all of it. And he had, I think it was $500,000 for that hour budget. And at the first time I was calling data centers, and were there, I don't care about the marketing, don't tell me infinite. How many GPUs do you really have? It was a really interesting thing. And he'd never managed to spend all that money. Now it would be very easy. But at the time, he had with that same budget, he did a couple, I think, of rounds to get it all. What it showed on the other side is that we were able to bring up, I don't know if it was, I'm going to say a number, but it might be slightly different. It was 20,000 VMs up cloud vendors in all regions in the world in 15 minutes. So in 15 minutes, we were able to have 20,000 VMs up and running, synchronized and working. And same thing for turning them off. You say turning off 20,000 VM went down in 5 minutes. And you're there, Wow, that is a scalability, which is mind-blowing. Oh, so well done, guys, managing infrastructure, because that is huge. At the same time, that was a problem he had for scientific research. Volume really is available for cloud vendors, and they are doing it exceptionally well. So if you need that, brilliant.
Yeah, it's crazy the things that we can achieve, like you mentioned, you know, having all the GPUs or all the spot GPUs that you can have in the warm.
Yes.
At the accessible of like clicks. That's crazy.
Yes.
And, you know, talking about these experiences, what do you think are the mistakes, you know, that we can have on context and adding context to the cloud financial data? Like we have seen, like, you know, you share case studies that look awesome, but what are the mistakes that people normally do with that?
Well, I would say you go, it's as usual, it's the, there is a saying in French, which is le trop est l'ennemi du bien. The too much is the enemy of the good. Okay. Which means that when you start expanding, let's go back to the top down. When you start with the top down and you start enforcing things to a level that is not your competence anymore. So if I, as the CTO, I decide we are just going to use this type of instances, that is so totally out of your depth in theory. You should not make these decisions. I'm still talking about a big enough company. Your job is to make sure that IT get the budget and that it is allocated correctly. That's it. VP of engineering will start working and et cetera. And so you go down. So one thing is to be too prescriptive so that at that point you kill creativity. You always need to assume that the engineers and the tech people are still very creative, because it's still a job that is not standardized enough to be non-creative. By the way, there is the Pixar book on managing creative people, which is an absolutely must, which is genius. But so that's a mistake. The other mistake is just, again, is to throw data at people, expecting them to understand your context, is to not put yourself in other people's shoes and assuming that they are stupid or that they don't know their stuff and they should know my stuff. Always assume that it is you. So the mistakes are going to be there. For context, not enough or too much. That's why I'm trying to figure out those five things. And say, look, you have five things you should say, and they should stand in a graph, okay? We're not talking about trying to explain the world to everyone. Those are the things. And last but not least, that comes to mind, and we've talked about before, is assuming that, people, they should know they're stupid or they're doing it on purpose against you. And you say, look, in a company, it's extremely rare. It's usually you have incentives. And eventually these incentives are badly designed. And yes, you're trying to game the system. Is that a bad thing? It's the system that is wrong. Don't change the people, change the system. And that is the thing that comes from good leadership, in my opinion. And that's the thing you need to go for. So I hope that kind of answers your question.
No. It does. It definitely does. And when you said it's, perfectly, because you need to put things, as mentioned, in context. And what you said about the system is, like, you have to, in FinOps in general, like incentives, is one of the, you know, things that, that one of the leverages that you can have that are more powerful in the practice, right?
Yes, but and you always need to think about that it's going to be in some form way gamed, okay? And you need also to remember that the extremes are usually, if you were to say, hey, you get a bonus if you reduce the by 25%, say, okay, oh, it's proportionate, and you say, well, perfect, I'm just going to turn everything off, I'm done. Oh, massive bonus for me, absolute horrible for the company. They'll come back and say, oh, that's not what we intended. Well, yeah, but that's what you intended by putting that, not requirement, but that incentive.
Yeah.
So it's very important to, when you set incentive gamification or this kind of stuff, I highly recommend you to have a time period, an end to that, so you can review, is it doing what we are expecting? Yeah. And don't put extremes or unlimited boundaries, because you're going to end up in a mess. Because, the developers, or we are all techies, we know the math usually. That's why we don't play at reinventing casinos most of the time. But on the other side, if there is a way that math is involved, how we can trick and tips and change, then we'll probably do it.
Yeah, definitely. And what you said is like the most representative case, I think, in FinOps, especially to illustrate, like to work on the business value and not on the cost, right? And one of the most used examples. And, you know, one thing that you said about we are from the techie side, we always like, you know, tools and technology. So what do you think, like what tools or what tech can be used to make top-down FinOps or make context possible in a company? What do you have in mind?
So in FinOps, we still have a set of tools, and they're trying to do lots of things, but they're trying to be everything for everyone. And as I said, I see enterprise, so the next level of software development, which we are not there yet, to be a very strong, stable thing for everything that is standard. And yeah, the SAP, for example, or Oracle is one like this, is you have a database, all style is very strong. There is a strong base on performance, quality, etc. And you have a very simple interface, which is SQL in the case of databases. And on top, you do whatever you want with it, because you need to adapt the tables to your need, to your data, to your queries, to all this kind of stuff. That's what I see an enterprise thing is, but it all starts from there is a strong base that you can solidify. Salesforce does that, it was able to do that because the CRM was quite clear. Oh, there is a lead, there is a prospect, there is an opportunity, there is a company, all this kind of stuff. We are not there yet, I think, with FinOps. So at the moment with FinOps, I would say you probably will need to, that's why people are using 4 or 5 of them. There is this aggregation that's happening at the moment. It's probably going to go into that direction. But to answer really your question, it is, so I see, and I think I've put it in the notes from our thing. So the first thing is you start the, where is it? Anyway, you start with decisions, and decisions are usually on pen and paper. So you start with a pen and paper, and then that's the first tool. The tool, technologically tool that can work, and I've been working with them quite a lot, is the policy, is to be able to transform high-level mandates into policies that are overarching, okay? I'm not going to force you to use a tool or another, but I want to make sure that if I'm in a bank, you're encrypting everything. I need to validate that because, yeah, my mandate is to be secure because otherwise I lose customers. So I think you have policy engines are really powerful. There are potentially also orchestration systems that will help you with that. I will glue things together because you need to glue things together today. And then you need to ask and be a pain with your vendors to say, yeah, but my whatever do not understand what this graph is about, or how does that relate to my thing? Remember that the more data, we have tons of data, And that's why we want FinOps to expand horizontally with scopes and go all over the place, which I like. At the same time, I see it as a dependency. We are curious animals. I think the National History Museum was showing in London, was showing that curiosity is an instinct. So if I can have more, I will always ask for more. Do I know what to do with that more? Probably not. And so the point is, what I'm saying is from the tools is start by your questions and then go and see if the tool answers those questions or ask them to answer the question, which is why we do custom things lots of the time. That's why Excel still exists. That's why every data goes through Excel, because Excel is the most contextualized thing that you have. And by the way, AI is the same. We love AI. That's the superpower of AI. I wrote an article on this. It's because it's contextualized. I can say, hey, tell me as a PhD in FinOps, or, oh, I know nothing about FinOps. I change my context, I change everything. I change all my answer. So tools at the moment, I don't think we have the maturity in cloud, and the cloud vendors do not want that maturity completely to get through. They don't want to be a commodity or commoditized, because let's be clear, the relational databases is a commodity. That's why you have tons of them. It's just, it's a mathematical problem. And now there are best people doing it in certain way or others, but you need that level of commodity that we do not have in cloud. So the tools, I would say, pen and paper, communication, fortunately Excel for you, probably policy engine would help if you're in a big company, really helps to make sure that everyone's following at least that minimum baseline that we can agree on. And then underneath, yeah, you'll have multiple tools and use each tool for the niche they're trying to cover. And don't believe the hype of, we do everything for everyone, because everyone, every vendor is correctly following their customers. Not all their customers, their biggest customers. Cloud vendors are the same. When they tell you, we follow the customers, I say, yes, but Netflix is more important than me, I guess.
Yeah, I guess the big ones are, you know, it's what drives the priority of the business. And you said it right. I totally agree on policies, like independently of the tool or the native one integration that you have, they are mandatory, I think, for any big company, because otherwise, like, policies and automation, that's where you are going to ingest things. And
But build them from the top down. So build your policies based on what your bosses, wherever you can go at the top. And if you can justify it going down, on the way I say it is, take the big guess, the big yearly guess that every company will have. That is called the business plan for the year. When they tell you we're going to grow by 20%, if you attach anything you do to this kind of the business plan for the year, the objective of the year, the strategy of the year, you're going to be able to justify almost anything you do in an extremely easy way. I'm going to ask for more budget, for 20% more budget, because the boss says we're going to have 20% more customers. Yay!
Yeah, and it makes it way more, you know, let's say sellable, or way more easy to achieve, because you have a goal. So you can have a focus, and by having a focus, you can have more, like, you can have infinite requests or infinite actions that you can take. But if you focus on the goal, then that's that thing. So talking about action and talking about goals is, you know, if someone wants to do all the advice that has been provided today, this week, like, what is the one thing that they should do to, you know, give context and make top-down happen?
I think it's read your company strategy. I would say that's the first thing you should do, because with that conversation, if you've got some aspect of it, which is we should, this top-down decisions have been made already. Okay. And they are written somewhere to get to that and start from that and say, how does it apply to me? It's going to make it much simpler to sell whatever initiative you have, but it's also going to make it much simpler for you to understand what is relevant and non-relevant for your business. Because that's the thing. Another thing is if you are one of these that feel that you have problem having engineers to do stuff, the FinOps things, again, another article, but there is this thing. If from the developer's perspective, for example, if it's not in the backlog, it does not exist. So instead of bombarding the poor engineers, go to the product owner. How do they get requirements? Can you have FinOps requirement to fit? Can you have some sprint points to be assigned to you so that they are rewarded? Because engineers doing the job you're asking them for FinOps are probably being slapped on the hand because they are wasting time on stuff which is not what's been requested. And so go to your product owner, have a chat with them. How does it work for me to be on your backlog so that I exist. And I think that would solve the problem that we've been plaguing people for 4 years and you're there, how can that be happening? So that would be my two things. Read your company strategy and understand, apply it to yourself. And the other one is if you want engineers to do stuff, have a chat with their product owner. So again, top-down FinOps, because that's the person that has the power to create a slot for your activities and will tell you why they can't do it this month because the release is in a week. So just get out of my way is a really good answer for them.
Yeah, I haven't thought about the product owner thing, but now that I am... especially like I'm working more of on that role than on the developer role. I totally agree. Like I am the one, let's say, making the calls and redirecting people to what they need to do and what they don't need to do. And that's like, if it doesn't come through, let's say, me or through anyone, then it's very difficult that it's going to be made by the company or by the team. So.
Yeah,
I totally agree. That's a wonderful advice for getting people involved. It's like, you know, you make it top down. You
yes.
achieve the product owner and then the engineers will do the work.
Especially you would be upset if you discover that one day of one engineer was lost trying to optimize a database that was totally unplanned and they've not delivered a feature and you're there. No, go back. But
That's great advice. And, you know, I think with that, we have more than enough that to cover today. So it's a pleasure to, it has been a pleasure to have you here, Frank. I think you provided a lot of wonderful advice. Thanks for being here today.
But my pleasure, and I will be slightly selfish promotion. I just published a book for managers. So please have a look at Protect the Doer. Let me know what you think about it.
Yeah, we'll put the links in the description below to all your stuff and definitely for the book because we love books here to be honest. And you know, pleasure to have you and see you all in the next episode.
Well, bye. Thank you, Victor. Bye everyone. Thank you, listeners.